This is car one. Say again, over.
They get going early. Staff from the World Food Programme had been up since 4 a.m., making final preparations, and we were in the cars ready to set off from the city of Erbil by 6:30. Journeys around northern Iraq are taking far longer than usual, as you have to skirt around areas now occupied by Islamic State. And this team had several sites they wanted to visit, trying to assess the food needs of refugees scattered over a wide area.
Hi, this is car one. Can you hear me?
There's an element of cat and mouse as the team try to keep up with the latest known movements of Islamic State militants. Indeed, it's the unpredictable ebb and flow of this conflict that makes it so difficult to supply food for all the refugees, as one of WFP's program officers, Mohammed, explained to me.
Sometimes we cannot reach our destinations. We have sometimes delay because of the security situation and let's say the driver's safety issues and the movement of the fighters between different areas. But we are doing our best to deliver the necessary assistance for all the internally displaced people in north of Iraq.
As we drive along, there are constant reminders of what kind of place Iraqi Kurdistan has become in the last few years. We've gone past lots of brand new houses and commercial buildings, some of them very smart indeed, and I've also seen some rather nice looking hotels which have been catering for the tourists who've come to Kurdistan from abroad and indeed from other parts of Iraq. I think most of the people are probably lured by the stunning mountain scenery that's all around us. But I doubt whether many tourists will be coming here at the moment, and indeed all of this economic development is threatened by the new bout of fighting that's been going on just a few dozen kilometres from where we are now. Our first stop was Demiz, a refugee camp about 100 miles northwest of Erbil. Here, they're looking after people who fled from Syria. The camp was initially supposed to hold 25,000, but new arrivals have meant there are now at least double that. No one's certain exactly how many. Among them was a man I met who is himself helping to run the camp's feeding program. He still has family in Syria, so didn't want to give his name. But he took time out from his work to tell the story of how he'd ended up living in a refugee camp.
I was in the army. Actually, I was a soldier. And my leader gave me order to kill my people there. I refused that, to kill our people. So I decided to escape from there. And I came to the border here. I paid for smuggler and come in to the camp. And till now, it's not getting better. Every day, it's tough, actually.
Can I ask, do you expect to get back to Syria eventually?
Actually, at first I was expect, but now big country around the world don't help Syrian people. I'm not thinking to go back. We didn't have anything left there.
The conditions here really are very tough, and mainly that's because of the quite unbearable heat. The temperature here gets up to about 45 or 46 degrees centigrade every single day, and well, I've just been walking around for an hour and it's got me completely beaten, to be honest, but these people, they are out exposed to the elements all the time. They can go inside their homes, but these are very rudimentary shelters. A lot of them have got these corrugated iron roofs, which makes things worse inside than outside. And hanging over all of this is the fact that most of these people have absolutely no idea when, if ever, they'll be able to go back to their homes inside Syria. But then we were reminded how things can be even worse. In the village of Khanke, we found a group of several hundred Yazidi refugees camped out in the grounds of a school. One of them told me what had happened to them at the hands of Islamic State.
They killed everybody they could, and they took a woman, they kidnapped a woman and children, everything. They are so bad, you know. We walk for some while, the children don't have food or drink, anything, something like that. And local people bring for us a food and something like that, but it's not enough. I don't feel safe at all because the Islamic militant can come to anywhere.
You don't feel safe here?
No, at all. We don't feel safe. The Islamic military are killing us.
Now you've got a little girl with you. She's what, how old?
Yeah, she's about 1 year and she lost all of her family. We don't know how to deal with. All of her family have been killed.
One image that people have from this crisis is of the thousands of people gathered together in refugee camps. But In fact, coming here, what you realise is that the problem is much more that people are scattered about. There's one group of tents in one place, there are people in a school somewhere else, even individual families in one building, and that makes dealing with the logistics of this crisis all the more difficult. And I'm here with the man who has to deal with that, Stefano Santarov from the World Food Programme. Stefano, how do you cope with all these people in so many different places?
Actually, you're right. The main problem we are facing here is to track all the beneficiaries that we might have. All these people coming massively from the Sinjar Mountain, they don't go at the hotel. They might go at the garden behind the wall. They might go at the football field. We cannot track every single person. Giving them food, it's extremely easy when we know where they are. When we don't know where they are, it's absolutely very hard to do that, but we are trying to deal with it in a very proper way.
Now, you have dealt with other emergency situations before in other parts of the world. How does this compare?
This is extremely new for me. I think that the main word here is fluidity of the movements of people. Compared to our emergency where I was before, in this case, the people, they're not starving. But the new thing that I'm facing personally, it's how to deal with the huge number of people displaced in a vast, vast territory.
As if to prove that point, we found another group of Yazidi people sleeping in the backyard of a disused building. They'd been there for 2 days, apparently unaware that there were facilities to look after refugees. Most seemed listless, as if past caring about their own welfare. But an interpreter managed to get a few of them to explain their needs. One of the Yazidis told me his name was Hassan. He went to shake my hand, but then seemed unwilling to let it go. An embarrassing moment, as he begged me to intervene personally to help their situation. I told him all I could do was to record what he had to say and make sure people got to hear it.
In the 21st century, the century of the culture and for humanity, the world is standing without any help. It's a really genocide. Where is the humanity? Where's the United Nations? No one hearing our crying.